This is a continuation of our interview with Mrs. Eva Cutler, tape 2, side 2. And so Father removed his identification.
And he would go out and he would get hold of food and take it in and distribute it.
Oh my.
And he would do that, you know, and I heard it from other people. In other words, my father wasn't talking about the things that he's done.
No.
He just did them.
He didn't. He and had non-Jewish contacts,
yes,
that he could seek out.
Yes.
And how long were they ghettoized? For months?
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
All I know is it was in the Hasidic area, mm-hmm, where the Jews were congregated to begin with. And there's a big, beautiful synagogue.
In that area?
That is in that area, Dohan Yotzei Templum. That is a beautiful architectural,
mm,
you probably heard of it.
I think I've seen pictures,
yes,
of it, yes.
Now it's no longer a synagogue from what I understand.
But the building is still there.
The building is still there.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't keep it up as a synagogue. Anyway, that's what I was confirmed.
Mm. Oh, that's the synagogue you went to?
No, that's not what I went to, but that's what I was confirmed.
I see.
So
they survived the ghettoization.
But what happened was, how they survived was that they were herded out of the ghetto, and from what I understand, that was the incident that I also heard of, and you might have, and they took them down to the Danube.
Oh, and put them on boats.
No. They just shut them down.
Some of them were put on barges.
And what did they do with them?
Oh, they just let the barge float and they drowned. But
oh,
in this case, they were shot.
They shoot, yeah. And so my father, of course, didn't know. They didn't know what was to become of them. And my dad said to my mother, they had their sacks, and my mother didn't look Jewish either. Probably that's what saved them partly, or whatever saves you, or you don't know what saves you. They were going with these guards around them, you know, with the bayonets and guns and such. And at one point my father said to my mother, look, I'm going to give you a signal. When I tell you now, you take the Mogendovidov.
Mm-hmm. He really,
and we are going,
was a fighter.
Yes, we are going. So mother said that she was like in a trance.
Mm.
And all, you know, she was like, father said now, and she did what she was told, and she went with him. And with all their stuff, they got on the trolley car.
Oh my.
Would you believe that?
Oh my.
And he went to a Gentile friend who put them up. They were already almost liberated. I mean, the liberating troops,
the Russian
troops were all around there.
Oh my.
And that's how they survived.
Do you know if other Jews attempted to do the same thing?
I don't know.
Or did they ever?
I don't know.
What a story that is.
And so this is what saved them.
Mm.
But what came after that they told me about, I would not have been able to survive it. I mean, the Russian liberation was a horrendous experience that you must have heard accounts of.
Excuse me, could I interrupt for just a,
yes,
moment, because I want to get back to Sweden,
yes,
and then we'll come back to this story,
yes,
if you're not too tired,
sure,
Eva. In Sweden, were you under the care of the Red Cross?
Yes.
Or did they, under the care of the Red Cross? Were you in a special institution?
Well,
or I guess a hospital first.
I happen to have had an injury, consequence to the malnutrition, that took me to a special hospital,
mm-hmm,
even a quarantine in Belsen when they first cleaned us up and separated us according to our conditions. And I have a disability,
mm-hmm,
that resulted from that, and I was in a special unit.
Mm-hmm.
They took a documentation on this effect. It's in my mouth, in my palate of my,
mm,
mouth. And there were some people whose facial, you know, who got
infections.
Not infections, they actually deteriorations, you know, rotting
the
of the rotting of the tissues, or the lips. They had to have cosmetic surgery done, and you know, so I was in a special unit.
Mm-hmm.
And then they took me to Malmö, to a hospital that I was to recover. And then from Malmö, I was taken into an area that was a Swedish-owned property. I understand it was royal property, the king's property. That was something similar to like a resort would be here.
Convalescent area.
Well, it was, I guess you could call it that, but we were already healthy. Well,
I see.
You know,
you were able to take care of yourselves.
It was primitive surroundings. They were like a wooden buildings, barrack type buildings with individual, you know,
cottages,
and no central heating. We were given the wood to heat our units and to maintain our own.
They gave you food, of course.
Yeah, we had a common dining room. We had a director of the camp,
mm-hmm.
director of the, you know, and health facilities set up. It was a very healthy environment. It was phenomenal.
Were there all Jewish
all
residents
Jewish.
There?
Yeah, we were all Jewish residents. I mean, we were all survivors.
Mm-hmm.
And
Were there several hundred people, would you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And they had several of these camps set up.
Mm-hmm.
And we were separated by nationalities and by sex, by gender.
I see.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a phenomenal experience.
Good care.
Super.
Super and humane.
Super
treatment.
Humane care, yeah. Super humane care.
And your experience of the Swedes must have been very, very positive.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Very humane.
Absolutely. And we created a communal environment there, learned how to ski there, made some contact with the Swedes that were interested. I was in a hospital there also later on for surgery because as a result of the condition that I suffered when I was recuperating, my tissues grown together and I couldn't open my mouth.
Mm.
So I was in a hospital and I made the acquaintance of a Swedish family. We have formed a Hungarian entertaining troupe, a dancing troupe. We had a former ballet dancer from the Hungarian opera company, Budapest opera company, and she choreographed numbers, and I loved to dance, and we made up our own costumes. And the curator of our group, of our camp, a woman, her name was Nordquist? No, that was a family, Nordquist. I forgot her name. She had a very Swedish name. She was chaperoning us and availed us for different performances throughout the Goodwill Tours, where we were really greeted like ambassadors.
Wow.
Red carpet banquets. We were performing. I mean, it was a highlight of my whole.
Oh my.
I mean, it was a fantastic experience there. And then the family that I made the acquaintance of there, I stayed with them, and they were manufacturing sporting attire, and they gave me an outfit for skiing.
So you learned to ski.
And I learned how to ski. Of course, naturally, I never became a sump. Some of them have become excellent skiers because
mm-hmm.
we were in an area up in the mountains.
What a juxtaposition from
yes.
your other experience.
Yes.
Oh,
and the children were going to school on skis. And so, you know, it was that kind of an area.
Mm-hmm.
It was between two lakes, Lokabrunn
mm-hmm.
is where I was.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to Karlskoga, and we went to, what was the other town? I don't remember. But it was really a very interesting
and
experience.
Wholesome life
awesome, yeah.
after such
yeah.
agony.
And
yeah.
they gave us an allowance, monetary allowance.
This was from the government, do you think, or the Red Cross?
I don't know. I think
maybe
it might
the
have
Jewish
been
community. Too.
Maybe the Jewish community is the Red Cross,
mm-hmm.
International part.
Agency.
I don't know. I have no idea. I never.
See, that too, I had never heard of this special. Recovery program, rehabilitation program in Sweden.
Oh, really?
No. So you see, that's also a very, very important segment.
You know, in retrospect, I'd say that if I can just disconnect myself from having been a victim, which I don't consider myself, because we're all victims, one circumstance or another.
Yeah.
I just consider it to be having been born in an era that you couldn't escape from. And if you turn these experiences into a valuable learning experience, I think you can build on it and you'll become stronger.
Some survivors are able, of course many are not. Many are just too crippled and too traumatized.
Emotionally, I understand a lot of...
And physically, too.
Yeah, physically, too.
So you were in Sweden then for about a year,
Yes, I was in Sweden for a year and I contacted my relatives in the United States. I remember their address.
Oh, my. The same family that refused to have you?
I was like, you know, I mean, I'm somewhat changed now. But I was close with my mother because my mother was angry at her sister. And she said, if we survive, I don't want to have any part of her. I don't want to do... She wrote a letter to that extent to her that she held her responsible if anything happened to us.
Well, it's a just judgment, I think.
Yeah, and I said to my mother, she's your sister, she's this and that. Well, I learned. I had to learn.
But you had remembered her?
I remembered her. I contacted them, and they didn't want to bring me over.
Even after the war?
They didn't tell me. They were stalling. I found out when I came here that she was worried. She was worried because she heard so much about the girls who were liberated, that they become whores.
Oh,
and she didn't want to take something like that on her responsibility.
Oh, my.
Okay?
Oh, my.
That was my aunt, who just died recently, and without me really being in touch with her, because I consequently severed relationships with them.
How did you get here then, Eva?
They brought me over.
They did bring you over?
They did bring me over. I was persistent. I told you if I make up my mind to something, I'd do it.
Wow.
Somehow I convinced her that I wanted her to bring me over. What happened was I said when I got contact just at a time when I was scheduled to board the vessel.
Mm-hmm.
I got a letter from my parents.
Oh, you knew
that they were alive.
Alive.
And that they got my letter.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was able to communicate with them
mm-hmm.
that I was on the way over to the States. But if they wished, I'd go home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so they decided that I should come here.
I was going to ask if you had thought about going back
to
Hungary.
They decided I should come here because they wanted to leave.
Now, they couldn't get out by that point.
They went through a lot before they got out because with this new government and send them, I wasn't a citizen yet, and my aunt and uncle's efforts weren't really all that
helpful
and they wouldn't get their visa, then they get their visa and they wouldn't get their passport, and so consequently what they ended up doing was they sold all their belongings and they hired a guide and they decided to go in on their own. And they left the country, in the night, you know, during the night, and they got to the border under horrendous circumstances and they passed on to Austria. And they were in Austria in the displaced person camp. I mean, my parents went through a lot.
Oh, my.
They
but what courage they showed, Eva.
Yes.
What courage.
But they didn't want to leave for a while because they were still hoping for my brother to come home. Because there was one of my brother's comrades that came back, and they had a rendezvous. He gave his comrade the address of my parents.
Mm-hmm.
And he came to visit up to my parents, so my brother never returned. So my brother must have either befallen victim to the Russians who captured the Jews on the way home and took them out to Siberia,
mm-hmm.
or he might have been killed on the way home in the battles.
You don't know.
We don't know what happened, but he lived up until the end.
You do know that?
Yes.
Is there any possibility that he's still alive?
No.
You know he died?
He must have.
Well, you must have.
If he's not in Russia, I mean, where else could he be?
Well,
he would
of course,
probably
lots of
have,
people are in Russia.
We have people, as it turned out. My friends are still in Hungary. I went back 37 years later and I found them.
Yeah.
So he would have known because there was one particular friend
mm-hmm.
who was very close to my brother and he would have known. if he got that.
But you never received any documentation. And your parents stayed in Hungary until?
Until they figured that he wouldn't come back.
Until?
And then they just left, you know.
They left in the early 50s or so?
I came over here in 46.
Mm-hmm.
So they must have left about 48, 49.
Mm-hmm. And had a very rough time under the Russians.
They had a difficult time because they didn't want to join the party because they really wanted to come here. And they didn't want to jeopardize their possibility, you know, their opportunity to come here.
Mm-hmm.
And they did have some difficult times. I must say, though, when I was taking piano lessons and I was like 14, I had a Bösendorfer grand piano. And after the war, and my brother had a very fine violin, and after the war, the first thing my father did is bought a beautiful piano for me, and two magnificent violins for my brother.
Oh, hoping that he would be able to use them.
Right.
So they came and joined you were you in New York?
It wasn't over yet.
No.
I came to Philadelphia, my relatives were in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents were in Austria, and my father was working for the United States government there in a development where they were building the housing for the troops, for the occupational troops there. And he was working in his field.
Mm-hmm.
He was supervising.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a good deal over there. They didn't tell anybody they were Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
My father never wanted anybody to know that he was Jewish after the war. And it was a little conflict between him and my mother. But the mother gave in. And they couldn't get into the States.
Couldn't get into the States.
So they had an opportunity to go to Canada, and they went to Canada.
I see.
And they were in Toronto for 2 years before they came here. When I finally became a citizen, they came here.
Only then were they able to come in.
Yeah. But that was after I got married. Because I got married a year after I became a citizen. And then my son Gary was born a year later. And my parents came when Gary was about 6 months old.
What a saga.
Yeah.
Is there any message you would want to leave for the younger generation? Some things, yes.
Pardon me?
You've already indicated some perceptions, anything, signing up?
I told you that I went back to Hungary after 37 years and I've discovered my friends, the same friends that I was members with in this youth organization in the synagogue. And I have found that this very dear friend of mine who was captured in Auschwitz, she's alive.
Mm.
In fact, I'm corresponding with her and another, all my close friends. And we were just a group of us.
Mm.
And I was very disturbed, but I understand that she had been going to a Jewish gymnasium. She was given a very, they were more Jewish oriented than I was. Her family was. She has become a communist. Her children are not Jewish at all. They weren't circumcised. I had spoken to her. I was very upset. She understood how upset I was. She said it wasn't easy for her to make this decision. But she said made this conscious decision because she felt that she couldn't accomplish anything by remaining a Jew. And she really doesn't believe that we should have this kind of division.
She married a non-Jewish man?
No. Her husband was Jewish. Her husband was from the group that we were going to together. He is also a friend of mine. I went to religious classes with her husband.
Does he feel similarly?
Even more so. Her grandchildren don't even know that she was Jewish.
Mm.
And some very upsetting things came out of this that I pointed out to her that she's, even if she made a choice for herself, I don't think it's right for her to forget the ill effects that it might have on this generation if she's completely ignoring it.
Not to have shared any of this past with the children.
No. But a very interesting thing is evolving in Hungary as a result of the 40-year anniversary. There have been books written. I would love to get hold of them. One of them I started reading was written by a non-Jew. And very interesting concept of how this thing has evolved in Hungary, and they do not want this to repeat itself.
So there are warnings, and there's an effort to really write the history as it happened, not a distorted history as is taking place
elsewhere.
Yeah,
there are people who are standing vigil.
And there's a viable Jewish community in Hungary. It's what, 200,000-300,000, I think, still left?
It's confusing because they're not practicing Jews. Very few practicing Jews. That's why synagogues are not able to keep themselves.
Well, under communism, it's very hard.
Yes. But it isn't that they tell them that they can't. But they don't get any government support, but neither do they get any government support under the Hungarian regime.
But you get many advantages if you join the party or if you come along and are fellow travelers.
Not in Hungary. In Hungary, it isn't like it's in Russia.
No.
In Hungary is pretty free of
discrimination. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
At least what I got from my friends.
I understand that Hungary is one of the freest of the communist nations in Eastern Europe.
Yes.
But your friend has just gone to the extreme.
Yes.
She may be sorry someday, even.
Well, she joined the Communist Party, and she said that what she wanted was to help build the country. And they all physically got involved in government and helped build the country to what it should be.
But doesn't she feel there's a great deal of communist-inspired anti-Semitism?
No, there is no communist-inspired anti-Semitism. That is anti-Semitism. It's not communist-inspired. It's anti-Semitism.
She doesn't know what's happening in the Soviet Union, obviously.
I didn't discuss that with her. What's happening in the Soviet Union is not happening in Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the two things are separate. We have to separate it.
Yeah.
Because there are two different governments, even though they're allies.
Mm-hmm.
It's like we have allies in Germany, we have allies in Israel, but we still have a different kind of thing going on here than there.
It's certainly interesting that she has this complete estrangement from Jewishness. These commemorative services, though, in Hungary, will undoubtedly, I think, force her think back over what has happened.
Nobody has to force us.
But in her own consciousness,
don't
you think that will trigger something?
We've been discussing it in the letters, and the both of us are very much in concert in how we feel. She and I are so much the same, philosophically.
Oh. But you would want to disown the past.
Well, my circumstances have evolved differently. I didn't want to take part in rebuilding a country.
And
trying to help that country overcome that kind of discrimination to perpetuate it. What they were trying to do is build the country without and freeing that country from
these prejudices.
So
you agree with her then?
I think in her particular circumstance, I think she did what she consciously projected would be an outgrowth of her efforts.
Suppose one of the grandchildren finds out that his or her grandmother was Jewish, and
but
that's bound to happen.
It's not supposed to make any difference, but this is what upset me,
mm-hmm.
that her husband was telling me and I was very offended by it,
mm-hmm.
as a humorous, little
mm-hmm.
incident that her kid heard, her grandchild heard somebody saying something, making slurs about Jews, like kids do,
mm-hmm.
like a verse type of thing,
mm-hmm.
and she was repeating it.
Uh-huh.
She came home with it.
And what did the
And then my girlfriend told her that she was Jewish.
Oh, she did.
Yeah.
And didn't the child have a lot of questions?
No, she was surprised. I mean, children repeat things; they don't know what they're saying or why they're saying it. She told her, and I said, you see, That's what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. I said, you ought to have a little more awareness instilled, because even if you resolve your life, you're responsible for what's going to happen later. So she agreed with me.
She agreed with me.
I made a very strong impression on her that.
Mm-hmm.
I said, we're responsible. Because you can't erase it.
No, you can't.
No.
Would you have any other words to American Jewish youth or American youth in the light of your experiences, Eva?
The only thing I can elaborate on is that I don't think we are a superior race. I think our circumstances have made us more aware that we have to perform and we have to be good enough and better in some circumstances in order to survive. We have to prove ourselves because the world is against us, but we are no better than the others. I don't like that attitude. I think that attitude also creates hostility. I think we're inviting hostility a lot of times. I think we have to learn that all people on this earth are really brothers. And if we're not going to accept that, we're doomed. That's all I can say.
Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
is tape two, side one, continuing our interview with Mrs. Eva Cutler. So you were saying that they put you up on the grandstand of the football field.
Well, what happened, it wasn't just a grandstand. You occupied any space you found. I mean, we were a great number of us. A lot of
thousands?
Women. Thousands of women, yes. We were going, we were absolutely exhausted because we didn't know what was happening, and we were walked all the way over there on foot and with our belongings. And it was raining. It was a horrendous experience simply because we were so unprepared. Like my
where
mother.
Were they? Where had they told you they were taking you to?
They just told us to go to that to go, and we gathered on the field, and
mm-hmm.
and they didn't tell us anything much.
You were being led by Hungarian police or guards?
Guards.
Guards.
Yeah.
And what weather? What time of the year was it? Do you remember?
It was in the fall.
In the fall.
Yeah.
So this was the fall
was
of '44 already.
I thought I was in the last transport, but I was in the one before the last.
Had there been earlier transports of women who had been drafted?
Not that I know of.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so. This was the last effort, and then I learned later that it was a result of Eichmann's doing. Eichmann was in Budapest, and I didn't know anything. We never heard his name.
I was going to ask. You never heard his name?
Never heard his name mentioned. Never. We knew that the SS had up in Schwab Hedge, one of the mountains in Buda, they had their headquarters set up there, but we didn't know who was there.
It's curious. You
yeah.
never heard of his name.
We never heard his name, no.
And so what happened to you after you were walked to this football field?
Well, we walked, my mother, in his last effort, whatever we had in the house, she prepared food for me and put it in my knapsack and part of my things that she has gathered for my dowry, linen, stuff and things taken with me. We didn't know what was happening. And when I finally got up there, I lost half of my food, got soggy, and I fell out of my sack, and I was distraught, and was tired, and didn't know, you know, the uncertainty of things. You didn't know what was happening. You had no control over a situation. And unfortunately, you know, I mean, there were a lot of women who, friends that had the ways to get out, that they managed to get back home somehow. I had a friend who proved not to be a friend. I mean, it was like they turned people against people all the time, you know. These kind of situations.
Every man for himself.
Yeah.
But some were able to escape and go back home.
Some of them had ways of getting back, proved immunity or whatever. But later on, they managed. They were gathered
again.
And some. It was a chaos, total chaos. So I have, as a matter of fact, I had a friend of mine who was married at the time, and she. They separated the married and the unmarried in lines, and she had to go into another line. And after the war, she was telling me that she had such pangs of conscience that she has abandoned me.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted to always know what was happening to me, to tell me how she felt,
mm-hmm.
and to tell me that she had no control over the situation. Fortunately, I managed to see her after the war,
mm-hmm.
I mean, just recently. But at any rate, chaos. And from there they took us to Buda, to this it was used as a summer
resort,
a sort of a resort, a swimming pool resort, like a swim club would
mm-hmm.
be. And we were there for overnight, and the kinds of things that they pulled on us, like for instance, they would cook a meal, and we were hungry by that time. We were tired and hungry and distraught and frightened. And so just before the food would get done, they would get us together and leave.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, what happened, some people almost fell into the to the pit where they were cooking the meal because we were hungry, but we wanted to get something, and then they would give you maybe a slice of bread or something. So this was consequently a pattern that they were trying to apply to break our morale. And
these were all Hungarian guards?
Oh, sure. And then we went through towns after towns after towns.
Just marching?
Marching on foot. And we were attempting a few times, we attempted escape. We went into the properties of landowners in stables. We were trying to hide in a stable, in the haystacks. And we've had experience there that, you know, was really horrendous. The kid of the property owner discovered, and he was luring us out with food. He said, "The ladies, here is the soup." We got out, and the guards were there waiting for us. And then, you know, kind of stuff. We were walking on the Viennese highway alongside of the ditches, you know, the side ditch. And we were sleeping in there, huddled in there, sleeping with our blankets or without on the ground, huddled together. And of course, the winter came upon us. And a lot of people had frozen to death. A lot of people have gotten injured, and they would do away with them on the way. They wouldn't want to take anybody who couldn't walk.
You were
walk.
In the so-called death march.
Yes, sort of, yes.
Did you have any contact with Wallenberg?
Yes, at the border.
All right, so I don't want to interrupt you, but
yes.
this obviously was the so-called
was a death
march.
I faced I was almost shot because at one point we were in Hidak, not Hidak, which was the last stop. I don't know, we went to a sort of a farm land where we were stationed in a huge stable where there were some men also from Romania. I met some people from Romania. We had seen some horrible things, men in the wagons when we were stopping to get water. Nobody got water, and I recognized my uncle's brother, who looked like death run over, and he called out, he recognized me to give him some water. And we went and we picked up ice or snow and tried to, these are the kind of things that one sees in a movie, and I don't relate to it. I got it out of my system in a way, because I couldn't live with it. I just couldn't live with it.
And this lasted for weeks?
Lasted for weeks, for months. Mm-hmm.
You never stopped, it seems.
We never stopped. We stopped at this one particular place for some time, and I was with this friend still, and she went out to work. They wanted us to go out to work. And it was at the point where I just decided that I wasn't going to do anything. I had my feet were frostbitten, and my shoes didn't fit my foot. My feet were swollen, and I couldn't put my shoes on. And besides of which, I was lethargic. I just decided that it was ridiculous. I wasn't going to do anything about it. And I just stayed behind. Whatever happens, will happen. And they lined us up one morning, and they said, "If you're not going to work, this is it." And I said, "The hell with it. This is it."
They were going to shoot you.
They're
going to
shoot us. So they didn't shoot us.
They didn't.
No, because I'm here. So, and at one point, we started walking again. And in the meantime, I went out a couple of times to dig ditches. That was some other things that happened. This was the last stop, but before that, and it's kind of hazy in my mind because we went out and we were sent out in the mornings to do ditch digging. Mm-hmm. And the men were separate from the women. And as something happened in a men's camp where somebody kicked an SS's gun, and it went off, and an SS got hurt, and they didn't want to say who it was, so they took all the men, because they didn't want to squeal on each other, they took them all and they shut them all down. But before they did that, we had to circle around, we had to watch it, they had to dig their own grave, and stand by their grave, and shut them down. And there was a young woman who tried to escape, and they caught her, and they did the same thing with her. Mm-hmm. had her dig her own grave and shut her into it. So there were some horrendous things not to remember.
And when did you contact, or when did Wallenberg reach you?
From this
had you heard about him earlier?
No, I didn't know who he was.
You didn't know who he was?
I had no idea who he was. What happened was, on the last, and it's here I would like to mention something that I think is of utmost importance also. This was the last miles that I had a walk where they really didn't have any kind of mercy. If somebody couldn't walk, they just shut him. They didn't want to carry him on. And I couldn't walk because of what I told you about my feet. And my girlfriend was begging me because I was ready to sit down, just give in. And there was an officer, a German officer, who came and helped me. He told me to put my arm around him and he walked with me.
My word. Where did he come from?
He was one of the Wehrmacht.
But just came out of the blue?
Well, he was there with us. We never knew who was going to be with us.
You kept meeting different...
Meeting different detachments.
Groups.
Yes.
I see. And by this time, of course, your group must have dwindled to a very few. Or did you keep meeting new groups?
Well, no, our group was still going on together. But, I mean, we were a lot of us, but we were going to a destination we knew at that time, but we didn't know where it was. They took us to Hidegkut, which was the last station. Have you heard of it?
Yes.
And Hidegkut, I wasn't familiar with it. It was near Sopron, I think. And they have then, before they took us to Hidegkut, or was it after, before they took us to Hidegkut, that's when they turned us over to the Germans, officially, at the border.
And this is when you met...
That's when I met Wallenberg.
Oh, but the German officer you had
before.
Met earlier.
That was before.
And he helped you.
Yes.
And walked with you and kept
he
you
put,
going.
He put his arm around me. He said, put my arm on my shoulder. Mm. And he helped me walk.
Well, that's an important episode to record. And so at Hidegkut, then you encountered Wallenberg. Now, what was he doing?
He was standing at the border. He was a very tall, good-looking man. I didn't know who he was. And he called out to the group, and he said, in Hungarian.
He had mastered
In Hungarian.
Hungarian.
He mastered Hungarian. He said, anybody who has in her possession or not in her possession protectiveness from the Swiss or the Swedish government should stand out of line. And I was dumb. And by that time, I was also fatigued.
Oh.
And I figured, I don't have it. Never had it. I don't have it. I knew of it. That was another thing that the Jews didn't share.
You did know of it.
I knew of it. It wasn't available for us. We couldn't afford it. And in Budapest, the Jews did not share this kind of information.
Mm.
There was also a Swiss house, which the Swiss government has declared to be, say, a neutral ground.
Mm.
And they took as many children in there as they could.
Is that so?
Yes.
I've never heard of them.
Yeah. Children and youngsters underage. And I understand that was later invaded by the SS anyway.
Oh, so
yes.
Those children
so
didn't
was,
survive.
Yes, they, some atrocities that was horrendous that I
Must
heard.
Must have been the Arrow Cross.
Yes. So, but anyway, I just,
you
didn't know who he was. I knew what he was talking about, but I said, well, I just don't have it. It doesn't make any difference. And I just ignored it.
Did many people step out?
Quite a few people stepped out. And I understand from one account that he took them back to Budapest. And then they were recruited all over again.
But you went on into Germany?
I went on to Germany. I went on to Hidegkut. And that Hidegkut experience was worse than a nightmare. It was the coldest time of the winter. We were unprotected. We were sitting there We were not allowed to sit, but a lot of people ended up sitting down.
Was this in the open? Or
in
was
the open. There was absolutely no shelter. Mm-hmm. By that time, our clothing was ragged. Mm-hmm. Our conditions were fragile. And, I mean, it was just, and a lot of people stayed there frozen. They just died. And that's where they came in with the cattle carts, and that's where we were herded into the cattle carts and taken. But preceding that, I want to point out something that I have, I have very deeply imprinted in me. The attitude of the people as we were marching through the towns.
Yes.
It varied from town to town.
Now, you were going through, of course, Hungary and Austria.
No, just Hungary.
Just Hungary. And then into Germany.
Well, through the Austrian border, where we were put into these cattle carts, and we didn't come in contact with anybody at that time.
Tell us about the
But the Hungarian population,
the
Hungarian people were a very curious bunch, because there were townspeople that were waiting for us with warm soup, hot soup.
Is that so?
And with consoling words, and with compassion, and with sympathy. And then there were towns that were just extremely the opposite, that took off stuff from our backs, hurled all kinds of nasty, unkind remarks at us, were telling us that they wouldn't barter with us. We were bartering for food,
sure,
with whatever we had.
Sure.
They wouldn't barter with us, because what are we going to do with our belongings anyhow? Where we go, we don't need it.
Mm.
And it went from town to town. It was an experience. If I was a writer, and oftentimes I think I really would like to write a book.
Maybe. See, I've never heard this either, that there was such variation, and that you did have some compassionate help. That's important. So you were able to sustain yourself with this intermittent help.
Yeah. So, that's why I say, as far as I'm concerned, my personal experiences have really been valuable, because it gave me a great deal of strength.
And insight.
Yes, and insight. And
do you have any theories as to why there should be such variation? Or is it just that some people are nice and others are
What's really curious
ugly.
About it is that it varies not by individuals sometimes, but by
area.
Environments.
Area.
It's some areas. And it I don't know what the influence might be,
yeah,
whether it's the terrain, whether it's the circumstances by which they live, what kind of influence triggers off this kind of
certainly intriguing. Did these people know that you were Jewish girls?
Yes, they knew we were Jews.
They knew you were Jewish.
Yeah, they knew that we were going to be taken someplace that they don't have to deal with us anymore.
Interesting. But without this help, you probably would have perished.
Well, yes, I'm pretty sure. I couldn't go that far to really analyze it. I don't know what kept me alive. I really don't know. It's just, I guess, wasn't my time.
Well, there must have been something pulling you and pushing you, perhaps the thought that you would see your family again? Or is it your friend?
We didn't know. We couldn't, it's a kind of thing that when you're
you
in a situation
didn't intellectualize
like that,
so
you
much.
Can't. No, you can't. I mean, you don't know what hit you. You don't know why they're doing this to you. You don't know why the rest of the world is just not even taking a notice. We were waiting for the American troops to come and liberate us, and we were waiting for the paratroopers to fall out of the sky, and here we are, out in the open fields being bombarded while we are walking through the land. As a matter of fact, I was so resigned that I fell asleep during the air raid, and I didn't even want to take notice if a bomb fell down on me. People went home to tell my mother. This mother said, "That's my daughter." I mean, I have a certain attitude and nature that I think that helped me through many crises, even after the concentration camp, that helps me sustain and stay above.
Mm. There obviously is some spirit, spark.
So that trip on the in the cattle cart was one that I could not, even if I wanted to give you an even close description of. It was something so inhuman. It was something so, I think the animals are treated better.
And
when
now you
being
were
carted
in,
away.
In German hands.
We were in German hands, I believe, yes. They didn't know what to do with us because the roads were cut off. They were determined to get us out to the camps. We were rerouted and rerouted and no food and no drink. And people went mad. I mean, there was there were women who went